Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of the Scared to Dance podcast with me, your host, Paul Richards. Over the course of this series, I'll be talking to some of my favourite people about their musical passions past and present. These include people who have DJed our club night, as well as those who have created our film nights. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Stuart Murdoch from Bell & Sebastian down the line. Stuart formed Bell & Sebastian in Glasgow in 1996 at Stow College, and the band soon released their debut album, Tiger Milk. Following the critically acclaimed If You're Feeling Sinister, the band won Best Newcomer at the 99 Brit Awards after release of their third album, The Boy with the Arab Strap. The band have released 12 studio albums to date, culminating in the back-to-back releases of A Bit of Previous and Late Developers. His latest book, Nobody's Empire, was released in 2024. Welcome to the show, Stuart Murdoch.
Hello. Hi, nice to be here.
Stuart, we last talked when I interviewed you for the 10th anniversary of your film God Help the Girl at the Glasgow Film Theatre. What was that experience for you like after such a long time?
It was nice because I hadn't thought about it for so long. You know, when I was actually making the film, I was completely submerged in it. And then just to actually show it. But then, you know, it was nice and we had a Q&A and we took some people out afterwards and showed them some of the locations. I remember it was pouring with rain, but it was still lots of people following me around the sort of West End. And it was amazing how compressed, how close together all the locations actually were when we did the little walking tour. And then right at the end, I just bade everybody farewell and walked in a different direction and left them down by the Kelvin River to find their own way home. But there was something really, it felt, because that was the end of the Bully Weekend that we had done. And it was it felt like a really nice way to finish the weekend.
I remember you saying during the Q&A, it was a bit like looking back at an old diary. Is making another film something you would like to do in the future?
The little flashes that I've had in the past few years, the one thing about God Help the Girl is that it took a long time. And I felt I learned a lot. It took a long time to get to the place where we were making the film. But the actual making of the film was like a car crash. It was so fast. And I was, you know, I was nothing except an inexperienced director. And so I do feel that if I was involved in another movie, that I would have so much more experience. And so, you know, you only learn how to do a thing by doing it. And you get better at it. You know, it's like making our first record, that, you know, and then we got better. So I think maybe I wouldn't be in such a rush to direct next time, but I certainly would maybe like to, you know, write another screenplay, work on more music and, you know, be involved in movies in some way.
Yeah, and you've had that simulation outside of the band and you've now written your debut novel, Nobody's Empire, which is loosely based on your own experiences. Can you give us an outline of the book?
So Nobody's Empire is a snapshot. I mean, you know, we were chatting beforehand and you were saying, well, it's not really autobiographical. Well, it actually is. It centers around a guy called Stephen, who's very like me. And what happens to Stephen is really what happened to me. And, you know, there's other characters and they're like other people I knew. But I chose to write it with changing names because I wanted to write a story and I didn't want to be encumbered by the truth. I didn't want to be encumbered by what actually happened. So it just was easier for me to write it in that sort of autofiction way. And it was, the action all happens about 30, more than 30 years ago now. It all starts in Glasgow in 1991, where Stephen has just got out of hospital and he's had a torrid couple of years with chronic fatigue syndrome, ME, just getting worse and you know, ending up in hospital and his life completely changing. So the novel starts with him kind of at the bottom, sort of spewed out from the hospital. And it's like, okay, life starting over again, a complete blank slate. Where do I go from here? I don't have any friends. I don't have any energy. And that's where the book starts. But he gets a friend, Carrie, who also has chronic fatigue syndrome, and they form a, and then he has another friend, Richard, who ends up getting a flat and they move back to Glasgow. And it's just the story of the three of them and how they survive and try to make a life, a new life for themselves, contending with illness.
So in that period between the late 80s and the 90s, you were suffering from chronic fatigue syndrome. What would have been the albums you were listening to at the time? Did you find that helpful in terms of dealing with your condition?
Yes, definitely, completely. What actually happened in a music sense was that 90% of what I was listening to, maybe even 95 or 99% of what I was listening to before, fell away. In the 80s, I was a huge consumer of music, and I was a professional consumer of music because I was playing records out on a Thursday, Friday and Saturday. So I was playing all the new stuff, indie stuff, all, you know, a great mixture of hip hop and house. And but when I got ill, you know, my DJing commitments were the first thing I gave up. And, you know, and I didn't listen to music, especially it was about a year where I was so unwell that I just couldn't bear it. It was too stimulating, and also it was too painful to, I just couldn't listen to music. And it's documented in the book. There's a moment where Stephen's in hospital and he's been in there for about a week. And, you know, he's starting to eat again because, you know, he lost lots of weight. And he has his Walkman with him and he puts on one song, Can't Be Sure by the Sundays. And that's the first song that he's listened to for so long. And it's the new Genesis. It's like ground zero. That's, and he could only listen to that song. And then, you know, maybe a week later, he puts on the Cocteau Twins and listens to one of their records. And so it's almost like, and this did actually happen to me. You know, the years went on, 91 into 92 into 93. I was very fussy about what I would listen to, and it had to be music that was a comfort, but also music that completely engaged me. You know, I wasn't doing anything else. This was not music to wash the dishes to, or this was not music to run to, or you know, work to, the things I used to do. So, and that's why Felt became, well, it seemed obvious to me that Felt would become my main group, but there was something about their music that I found completely absorbing. And so that they became the group I listened to most.
That's really interesting. You said it was quite painful listening to music at the time. Do you think that psychologically for you, that was a way of dealing with what was going on at the time in terms of moving on with your life as a kind of, not new and old Stuart Murdoch, but of a turning of a page?
Oh, well, it absolutely was. I mean, it was old and new. It was a complete new start. It was a complete new me. It was the main fulcrum of my life when everything changed. And so there was a lot of quietness, a lot of sort of emptiness. And the reason partly that music was so painful, just because I could, my system psychologically and physiologically couldn't abide, you know, the sort of music that I used to listen to. You know, I didn't really listen to the Pixies or Sonic Youth so much, you know, which I used to love, because I was just going slower. And so, yeah, it was just more gentle, easier music that I wanted to listen to. But saying that though, gentle was easier. I mean, I did listen to, you know, I was listening to Beethoven as well, which is not easy music sometimes, you know, like, or Bartok or something, where, you know, classical stuff, but it's engaging and lovely.
So going back to early in your life, I was reading that you were growing up in Ayr and your parents made you learn the piano. What age would you have been? Can you remember the first songs you would have heard or the first album you bought? Would that have been something that your, you know, a sibling would introduce you to?
So super, super early on, we had the radio. So that was the main thing. I remember my sister was into the Osmonds. This was like way back, you know, in the early 70s. She was in the Osmonds fan club, and me and my brother, we thought that was cool, you know. And she would get magazines, and we'd look at the magazines, we'd laugh at all the people. We used to call them the groovy groups, because it was just like, it just seemed to be page after page of like groups, so like people like Deep Purple and with who had really kind of long hair, sort of the whole hippie vibe. Yeah, my parents were into music, but not, you know, sort of classical and kind of maybe a bit of easy listening, or, you know, my mom just loved musicals. She just used to love watching musicals, and that was, and all that stuff. Obviously, that stuff was, you at that age, you absorb everything. We had a swing in our back garden, and I used to sit in the swing, and I used to sing down the top 10 records when I was, you know, when I was 5 or 6, because I know that, I mean, I must have been that young, because the swing was in the house in Glasgow, and we moved when I was 6. And so I had a keen enough musical sense that I could remember bits of the, you know, enough of the top 10. And funnily enough, I thought that that's what everybody did. You know, music was so pervasive, at least, you know, the charts were so pervasive. You know, you had Top of the Pops and you had the radio. So you'd hear a lot of music, even though you didn't have, at that point, you didn't have that much agency over what you could listen to.
So what would have been the first album that you bought for yourself? Was there a particular band or a musician that you fell in love with?
Well, the funny thing is that I'm sure if you ask various people what their first album was, they would tend to, you know, think, oh, okay, well, what was the first cool record that I bought, you know, and all. But in actual fact, the very first record that I bought was by Pinky and Perky. Little pigs that sang in high-pitched voices. And I got it at a Scout jumble sale. I've told this stuff to a couple of podcasts in America. And, you know, you've always got to explain Pinky and Perky. And then you've got the concept of a Scout jumble sale. So it's great that I don't have to talk about this stuff. So 50 pence, Pinky and Perky's Hit Parade Volume 2. But it was quickly followed up. I don't think it was the same Scout jumble sale. I think it was the one 6 months later. It shows you my music development, because then I picked up Bridge Over Troubled Water with Simon and Garfunkel, and just, you know, just picked it out randomly, thought this looks good. And of course, I never really stopped listening to that ever.
Yeah, so I'm a huge Simon and Garfunkel fan. I mean, their greatest hits is probably the one piece of vinyl I'd save if my flat was burning down. So just going back to Nobody's Empire, you became a DJ at the University of Glasgow, and in the book, the character is planning his DJ set. How fun was that? And do you miss it?
Yeah, for quite a while afterwards, it was, you get this feeling on a Friday or Saturday night, like, what am I doing here? Why am I not thinking about, you know, what you're playing? It was really all pervasive. You would know yourself, like if you're preparing a night and, you know, we'd start first thing in the morning. Okay, well, you know, what shops am I going to go to? What do I need? What gaps in my knowledge do I need to plug? What sessions do I need to tape off, peel? I mean, I actually used to play, I used to work in like peel sessions as well, like playing off cassette, which was, you know, a little bit of a risky business when you're actually DJing to a club full of people. But it was the right sort of people. So they sort of dug it, you know, they dug the fact that this version of 24-hour party people was from Peel. Yeah, I was really serious about it, you know. And I mean, I remember going out for my Saturday afternoon run and then always working through what I was going to play on the evening.
When Ben and Sebastian initially took off around 1996, who were the bands you were listening to? How did you feel about the contemporary bands at the time, or did the whole Britpop scene slightly pass you by?
Definitely. My obsessive stage was past, but there was a few exceptions. I thought as soon as I heard the Tindersticks, this is when I was getting an inkling of what kind of music I really wanted to make. And then suddenly those guys came along and I thought, fuck it. That was the first time I got really envious, because, you know, I thought they were amazing. And I just thought, that's kind of what I want to get into. And I don't think, I think it was quite an original sound at the time. I just, you know, the early Tindersticks singles in that first LP, I thought Stereo Lab were terrific. I remember hearing their second single and just thinking, wow, that's amazing. And so I remember going to see them live. And then there was Pulp, you know, there was, you've got to give Pulp their due, because I mean, I still was into Pop. So, you know, by the 90s, I knew I wanted to do it myself. But I remember going to see Pulp. I was standing at the back. This was still, you know, it was kind of in the days where I was like, back in the 80s, I would be right up the front. So I was sort of standing at the back thinking, okay, yeah, this, you know, I like their singles. Let's see what they got. And then they came on. And then I found myself, I was like, I kind of fought my way to the front. I thought, this is amazing. You know, so it's quite a rare, you know, by this stage for me, I was like, okay, I got to get the full experience here. So I managed to get right down the front. And then Jarvis started talking to the audience in this conversational way where it felt like he was actually having a conversation with the audience. He was actually listening to what people were saying, listening to comments that you couldn't quite hear, but he was sort of filling in for the people. So it was, you know, he had this skill that I'd never experienced before, because the bands that, you know, Dinosaur, the Mary Chain, you know, nobody had that personality. Nobody had that ability to engage with the audience and to seem interested enough to feel like the audience were real people to be reckoned with rather than just punters to be sang at. I thought that was terrific. I think that was kind of influential for me to see the way that Jarvis did that. Also, I really liked the first Denim record when that came out in, you know, 91 or whenever it was. It was completely different from Felt. It was like, you know, the Lawrence reinvented himself and went and did this pop record. But there was a lot of great stuff about that record. I remember dancing to that record, that track, Middle of the Road. And there's a line, he's dissing all this music, all these sacred cows, you know, everything from Aretha Franklin to early Dylan, and just saying, you know, it's not for me. I just like the middle of the road. I like pop music, and it's your music. It's your right to choose. It's your rock and roll. I thought that was amazing.
Yeah. So what have those bands been an influence when you're writing those early Belle and Sebastian songs that became Tiger Milk and If You're Feeling Sinister?
At that point when you're writing, you sort of put, I mean, you really do. And this sounds like insolence and hubris and everything, but you put your fucking influences behind you and you get on with your job. You really do. You have to do that. You have to feel, you know, we're doing something new here, or I'm doing something new. You work from isolation and you've got a chip on your shoulder and you're trying to prove yourself. Because I'd been trying to get this together for years. And, you know, so I was as serious as you could possibly get. It's probably no fun to be around. I was just so serious because I've been, you know, really writing a lot of music, and I thought, this is my turn. You know, I took one idea into the Tiger Milk sessions, and that was Rattlesnakes by Lloyd Cole. I think that was the only little benchmark that I had, just, you know, in the back of my mind. I just thought Rattlesnakes, you know, just. But that, it didn't really, I didn't think Rattlesnakes every day. I just thought, wouldn't it be great to make a debut album as great as Rattlesnakes? that's all I thought, you know. That was kind of like a kind of benchmark or something to aim at. And but then again, you put it to one side, and then you sort of get on with it. But I know there was, like, I think probably the Left Bank was a big influence. Love was a big influence. Love and Spoonful. You know, those more slightly groovy West Coast, lighter, the Birds, you know, that sort of thing were probably, you know, these were really, it's almost like the blood in your veins that was on, you know, deep background. And because I did have this, you know, notion of, okay, want to do pop music, but I want to do it with the cello as important as the guitar, and the harpsichords is as important as the drums. You know, and there's the Tinder Sticks again, you know, that they probably, you know, kicked that whole thing off for me.
You mentioned the Tinder Sticks and Pulp as contemporaries that you absolutely loved at the time. But do you feel that after the first two albums came out that you were part of something, or that you were these complete outsiders looking in?
We weren't even part of something in Glasgow. I mean, especially in Glasgow, you know, it's like, get to fuck. I mean, it's funny because Edwin Collins said a funny thing the other day. He said, you know, somebody pointed out that he'd said something rather nasty about another band in, you know, back in 1981 or something. And he said, well, that's what people did. That was what the scene was like back then. You know, it was catty, it was backbiting, and everybody was looking over their shoulders. And so I'm not saying it was like that so much in Glasgow. I just felt I was completely isolated. I do tell a story sometimes where, you know, people got so used to me asking them to be in my band that they would cross the street. I saw, like, hipsters, cool people, make a body swerve on Barge Road and crossing the street because they thought, this guy's going to fucking ask me to be in his band again. it was that ridiculous, you know. And being up at, I remember being up at the art school and chatting to somebody, and they said, "Well, what are you up to?" And I said, "Well, I'm trying to get a band together." And this person, I can't remember who it was just like, "Why would you do that? There's too many bands. Why would you do that? Look, would you know? I mean, are you going to be as good as the Small Faces? So fucking forget it, you know. Who do you think you are? Why do you think a wee prick from Glasgow can do anything?" So that was the prevailing attitude. The nice thing about the Bells, when you look back in it now, I mean, we're fucking misfits. When you see the ragtag bunch that got together to do this college project, this school project, I mean, it's a brilliant origin story, because none of those guys were in the cool set. We're complete ragtag, and I loved that. I loved it. It was, instead of me having to chase people, Bell and Sebastian were actually the first seven people through the door. It was the first seven people that I ran into when I was asked by Stoke College to make a record.
Can you remember what your expectations were at the beginning? Did you have any grand plans, or was it, let's just make an album?
At this point, I didn't think it could be a group that would be a going concern. I just want to make a record. That's all I wanted to do. That's all I had the provision in my mind to do. I was still, weak with ME, so I was so limited. But I thought I could make a record. I thought, I could control the whole thing, and these guys would come in. And so that was it. Yeah, we managed that. But it surprised me that, after we did that, we were kind of like, I think me and Chris and Isabel, you went on a drive to the countryside like the day after Tiger Milk. They were kind of like, okay, so what's happening? What's next? And I was like, I don't know. but it was kind of great, because we did have a sense. Most of us, particularly those guys and me, we had the sense we'd actually done something that was completely surprising. Chris never thought he would have made a record, and Isabel was, at that point, she was delighted to be in the studio. At that point, Jackson was this sort of unknown factor, because he was the one thing I couldn't really get a handle on. I didn't really know how he did what he did, or it was terrific. That was the great thing about his guitar. He just seemed to be able to pick it up, and it sounded like a full meal. It sounded like a band all on its own. And so Jackson was the kind of the X factor on Tiger Milk, and where we placed everything else around that. And so, but with Sinister, I wanted to do, I was getting a little bit more ambitious, wanted to make more use of the cello, violin and trumpet arrangements, wanted them to be a little bit more considered. I think, on Tiger Milk, we sort of recorded the four guys and then maybe added some, strings afterwards. I wrote all the songs for Sinister in a really short period of time. I mean, the band sort of really only got together at the start of 96. We recorded Tiger Milk in March, but I'd started writing the songs for Sinister around about, actually in probably February. I wrote The Fox and the Snow and Stars, The Track and Field the same day, I think. And, I wrote that, those songs, a really short period of time. The last song I wrote was Judy and the Dream of Horses, which is more like in the spring. And so we rehearsed a little bit more. I remember rehearsing with Isabel on her own, and maybe Chris on his own for a bit, and thinking about the parts a bit more. But instead of Rattlesnakes as my benchmark for Sinister was Tapestry and Court and Spark. That was I had two little benchmarks. And of course, those LPs were recorded by seasoned artists with the best session musicians, with careful production. There was a lot, there's obviously so much experience and know-how went into the making of those records. And so it was a high thing to aim for, and we fell short. But And the falling short was all in my department, because I had this overarching sense that I had to do everything quickly. If I didn't do everything quickly, they were going to stop me. I've been waiting for this moment for so long. You know, I didn't want to wrest any control. Sinister was at the height of my tunnel vision and just wanted to get it done. And I felt that if I didn't do it quickly, we felt this pressure, because at this point we actually had a record label called Jeepster. You know, those guys were like, you know, they kept phoning up on the first day and said, how many reels of tapes have you used? You know, like, you know, we can't afford that much tape. And it just, I already felt this pressure, you know, it was all the pressure was on me, obviously. And you know, I was just thinking, oh, fuck off, just let me get on with it. That was the vibe around Sinister. And of course, you got the group where they weren't just marionettes. They were living people, and they had their own opinions. And you know, suddenly during the course of the year, the personality of this band started to appear. And you know, by the end of the year, everything was ripped up. I mean, the kind of idea that I had of a group of that being this controlled thing, this baroque thing, was completely torn to shreds by the next recording session.
So that means by the time of recording The Boy with the Arab Strap, you're leaving this tunnel vision and things are becoming slightly more panoramic?
Well, it wasn't Arab Strap. It was the same year. It was 1996. We were, you know, we'd done Sinister, and we were back with an album's worth of stuff at the end of the year, ready to record again. But this time we said to each other, let's do singles. And so we had, like I said, we had an album's worth of stuff, but we said, let's do singles, let's do EPs. You know, that's what we were aiming for. But in a sense, it was just like recording an album. We had the same group of songs, but we did everything. It was completely different. That was like, it was only like 4 months after we'd recorded Sinister. I think the first thing that happened was that Isabel was kind of pissed off with me by that point, just generally. And she, you know, but, you know, in a healthy way, because, you know, this guy's like, you know, suddenly this guy that she didn't know 12 months ago was having all this sort of power over her life. Like, fuck this. And, you know, and Stuart probably felt the same. And, you know, so she picked up the bass guitar. Stuart was quite happy about that, went read his book, and everybody had to move one instrument round. and I was like, well, there's the Bell and Sebastian blueprint is fucked, it's gone forever. You know, and that was when we I think we see the Lazy Line Painter Jane, you know, Isabel she played the bass on Lazy Line Painter Jane. And also that recording was done not in a recording studio. We decided to record in the church hall where I lived, because we were a little bit disappointed in the sound of Sinister. It didn't sound like Tapestry. It did, you know, I mean, I know a lot of people love that LP and it's super, I think it's a really strong set of songs, but you know, it's quite lightweight sounding and that's fine. But we were, you know, when you're in a band, you're always trying to make something better, you're trying to make something good. So that set us off on this musical adventure, and it really, we never looked back from that point.
So in 1999, you won a Brit Award. What was that like? Suddenly, you're going from being in a band who are, you know, don't even bother, you're not the small faces, to being known nationally and then later on internationally.
I had some moments where this group could be great, or wow, we're actually doing it. But it wasn't the Brits moment. I mean, even just the first moment that Mark and Lard played the State I'm In on. I mean, that was a huge moment. But the Brits didn't mean anything to me in that sense. I didn't watch the Brits. I didn't care about the Brits. I didn't go to the Brits. It became mildly amusing. It was sort of, we were in the studio, we were still recording, and it was just, it was only Richard and Mick that went down. And when we won the thing, there was a I remember going to the newsagent that night with Chris at midnight to get the next morning's newspaper to read about the Brits. And we were the headline. And they accused us of cheating. You know, so that and I know that might seem like a joke now, but at the time, this felt like typical. We were just like, you know, we were a Scottish band working hard, just putting out records. And the one time that we put our head above the parapet and won an award, the Sun newspaper, we were on the front of the Sun and it said, you know, Brits band, a Scottish band in Brits fix. Shocker. And we, you know, me and Chris were like, at that point, you know, this was before the internet. I mean, we felt like we were under siege. You know, that obviously the press was now coming to Glasgow to try and find out what the story was. And we were in a bunker in the studio, and we were very febrile. We were ready for a fight.
I remember getting into Ben and Sebastian at university when friends lent me Dear Catastrophe Waitress and The Life of Pursuit on CD. How do you look back on those two albums, and what was it like working with Trevor Horn?
Yeah, that was great. It was happy days. This is real happy days, because it was kind of the bell's mark to the first 5 years of the group was, you know, Stuart left and Isabel, you know, she'd left before Catastrophe Waitress, and Bob had come in, and, you know, because we'd have that, you know, 1990,000 was rough, just, and my health was poor. And so I didn't really know whether the group was going to go on. And, you know, Bob came in and, you know, and the people that were there had to decide, but at least it was the people that really wanted to do it that were left. And so suddenly it felt easier. It just felt lighter. It was just like, no, this is great. We can actually, you know, we can carry on. We can do another record. And the great thing about doing a record with Trevor and then doing a couple of records with Tony was, for me personally, was that I didn't physically have to do so much. I know that might seem like a small thing or a weird thing, but, you know, up to this point, I was always co-producing and mixing with Tony Dugan back in Glasgow. You know, Tony was great. You know, he did a terrific job, and we had a lot of fun and everything, but it was so nice to just leave that and actually, you know, step into Trevor's world where Trevor was in charge. It was, you know, the pressure was on Trevor, and I could actually focus on singing and writing and, you know, a bit of arrangement, but not on production. And so then we had a great old fucking time. I mean, it was like the 2000s were just amazing. And, you know, a lot of people who know anything about Bell and Sebastian, if they know something at all, will probably think about those early days and, you know, and think, oh, well, the 2000s, that's when they lost it. Well, we didn't. We were just different, and we were having a great old time, and we were still super serious about the music. We actually got more ambitious in a sense that, and I think those records are quite robust.
With that record, did it come out the way you were expecting, or did Trevor Horn have a big input as the producer?
I think actually we expected Trevor maybe to, you know, to chop and shape us a little bit more than he did. But I think he was just really happy to get with the working band. I mean, his background was, he used to be in a band called Yes. He was in, you know, he was in Buggles, but he was also in Yes. You know, he was a working musician. So he really appreciated bands and guiding bands, and maybe hadn't done so much of that recently, especially throughout all the 80s where you're putting stuff together for the bands. And so, you know, we could play, and he was happy with that. He just guided us. I mean, there was one track in particular called Stay Loose where we thought we were going to get the whole Art of Noise treatment. We really thought he was going to, you know, break it down and start again. And actually, that was a song that he cared for least. It was weird because we thought, well, this is right up Trevor Strasser. You know, he's going to love working on this. And he sort of tolerated it. And he said, you know, we were like determined it was going in the record. And he was like, yeah, okay. You know, if you feel that strongly about it. But
But we had no, he had a, we had a we had a great time with Trevor, and he just allowed us to realize our kind of pop and rock ambitions. I think by that stage the urges that were coming through from different people in the group were stronger, and we went with those. It wasn't we weren't trying to create a tight baroque sound or anything like that. We're just, I mean, I remember, like, Cuckoo for Me, I'm a Cuckoo. That song, when I got into my head, was like a tiger. It just kept, I couldn't get rid of it. It was just going round and round all the time. And beforehand, I would always, write songs on the guitar, songs on the piano, take them into the group. Whereas this Cuckoo was just, it was like a radio switching on. I couldn't get rid of it. So that was fun.
You say you see that period of Ben Especially as Mark II. Do you see a Mark III?
Funnily enough, not really. I think it's the present band is pretty much a continuation of from the year 2000. It can't be underestimated what the sort of personalities in the group, the way that we consider each other. It's like a family. And I think from that point on, that's when that started. I have very fond memories of Stuart and Isabel, and of that being, that's definitely when the family started. But those guys grew up and moved away, and then the rest of us hunkered down. But yeah, it really from that point, the other key thing was that we became a touring group, and we were never a touring group before, and so we were a viable touring group, and that became half of the experience, and is to this present day. I mean, touring's, I never thought we'd be a touring group, and but we took it up in 2000, and then we've never left it.
And the band toured Europe and America and Australia last year. Do you get time to go to record stores and hang out and find out what's happening in those places?
Yeah, you get a little bit of time, and everybody does different things. I'm not the record store guys are Dave and Bob and Chris and Stevie, in that order. That's what they do. They still manage to, it's amazing to me that they manage to find the time. I'm not interested at all. I'm not interested in walking into a record store. I would prefer to go for a bike ride or find the local Buddhist center.
Are there any touring or album plans of Ben Sebastian this year, or are you waiting for 2026?
Yeah, 2026 is 30 years actually of the group, and I know these the whole anniversary deal is somewhat, mindless, but we haven't actually done the anniversary thing once. We did it. We played at the Albert Hall. We did Tiger Moth Sinister 10 years ago. So we're going to play some anniversary shows. We're going to mark the occasion with a sort of larger tour.
And will there be any new material next year, or will there be something a little bit further down the line? Because the last two albums, A Bit Previous and Late Developers, they came out quite close together.
Yeah, actually not, because what would usually happen is that we would be doing that now, and we're not, and we're conspicuously not. We're actually giving the it's almost like leaving a field fallow for a year. Like, we're missing it out in the cycle, and people are doing other things, and I've been supporting my book and stuff like that. So we had a little bit. We've given the recording a break for a year or so.
And have you considered writing more? Was the novel something that sparked the feeling of wanting you to write another book?
Personally speaking, I'm always working on something. I think I was working up until the point where the book came out. I was working on the book, thinking about the book, but now that the book is out, then I have this space in my head for creativity, and so I started working on, writing other songs, but more kind of more spiritual music, songs that could be hymns. I always love hymns, and I always think, oh, I want to write a few classic hymns, especially over Christmas. I was writing some songs. Yeah.
Okay, and is that something that would come under Ben Sebastian or something that would come under your own name?
Yeah, I don't know yet. I don't know. I think you know, might get together with a choir at some point and record them or something.
You mentioned earlier the Glasgow Weekender, where you kindly asked me to come and DJ, and it was a really fantastic lineup with C-Mac, Kemi Obscura, Disco, and the Chords all playing. How does that come together? Was the lineup chosen by yourself and the band, or, you know, are there other people involved?
We've done that sort of thing in the past. Obviously, we had the Bowley Weekender back in 99, so that was the blueprint for future Bowley. So, yeah, that was a collection of people that we were really excited to play with and who really wanted to come and be part of that weekender. It was a really nice lineup. I think everybody had a good time. But I do notice, like, I'm funny, just in my Facebook feed today, that I noticed there's a festival called Shine On, and it's doing Butlins this year, you know, and it's, you know, the Mary Chain and you know, a bunch of other things in it. I'm just thinking, wow, that just looks like but you know, the bowl, you know, it's just basically the Bowley sort of festival, but with the, you know, different bands.
Yeah, and Bowley became ATP, which I don't think a lot of people realise that Ben Sebastian started that.
Yeah, we kind of started. I mean, it wasn't the, you know, obviously the idea of the Weekender was like the Soul Weekenders and, you know, in the past, but the notion of the boutique festival where you get a bunch of bands together and actually stay under in chalets rather than tents and then, you know, show films and talk about music and all that sort of stuff. I think we definitely created that sort of blueprint.
And is there an album from the past 12 months that you would recommend? You know, is there something that's got you particularly excited?
I actually went to see Lola Young like last month at the in Glasgow, and you know, I love that song Messy, and I just thought her voice was amazing. You know, it's just proper. I think her voice live was kind of stronger, more versatile than even it showed on record. And she had a good band. So that was really exciting to see. You know, I was like, wow. You know, because I know that, for instance, like, there's a question mark and, you know, why are British acts or groups not making it in America anymore? And, you know, are we still producing them? But I think Lola Young's going to be a kind of a festival headliner at some point. She should be, you know. I think she's got a strong and interesting voice, like, you know, the best one since Amy Winehouse maybe. And also I went to see an Irish singer called Orla Gartland, and I'd expected it to be quite introspective, and I hadn't heard much of her stuff, and then I went and it was a party, you know. She's in your face, and people were super into that. I thought she wrote some really, really good stuff.
Stuart, thank you so much for your time, and very much looking forward to those shows next year.
Thanks, Paul. It was a pleasure to chat to you. I think we went pretty deep today.
A big thanks to Stuart Murdoch from Bell and Sebastian. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to subscribe and leave us a review. You can follow us on social media at Scared to Dance for news on our upcoming episodes, as well as our club night and film events. I'll be back next week talking to Asher Lorenz from the band Sorry about their new album Cosplay. This podcast was recorded and produced at Third Floor Recording.